Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of September 27th, 2013. If you listen to this show, or, you know, your family or Investing 101, you know that a personal finance basic is to try to make sure that the money going out the door is less than the money coming in. Yeah, we're talking budgets. So we went out into the streets of Washington, D.C., an apropos place to talk spending, to ask people how they manage their money.
How do I set a budget? Well, I don't really actually set a budget.
By considering all of my finances, including my salary, anything I've invested, and then I subtract from that the amount of my average expenses in major categories.
Seeing what my other expenses are besides bills and rent, setting aside a little bit for savings. I'm cutting out of my fund, but it's what you got to do. So,
based upon my income, I set aside a certain amount for bills. You've got everything that goes in a household.
That's a ritual that happens in many households, like those people said. You figure out your income, your spending, your priorities, and you try to set a budget. In Washington, well, you know, do I even need to spell it out? And in times of political stalemate, like now, a lot of politicians like to draw the analogy between a household's budget and the country's, saying if families can do it, the government should too. So we asked David Gura, who covers Washington for Marketplace, to talk to us about whether that comparison makes any sense. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Lizzie.
All right, so we're back to the debt limit fight again. This analogy of government spending to a household spending gets used all the time. Why does this happen?
Well, I think the real reason is because it's just so simple. It's something that we can really easily get our heads around, and we so desperately want that analogy to work. I remember talking to Jared Bernstein, who's an economist who used to work in the Obama White House, and he said to me, it's the kind of folksy sentiment that just resonates with people. It just sounds right. And so I think that's why we hear it time and time again. You're right. Every time we talk about the budget or the deficit or the debt ceiling, it comes up. And you know, the thing is, there are problems with it. And when you start to think about it, the government is so huge, Lizzie, all the programs, all the money, when you start to play out that analogy, it just doesn't really work that well. And you know, most basically, perhaps, most of us don't really spend within our means. I mean, if you want to buy a house, odds are you're going to take out some money to do that. So this argument that you should only buy with what you've got really doesn't hold water.
Let's break down spending. So I think about my own budget, right? I pay for housing, food, transportation, some luxury stuff. You have a new financial responsibility. You've got a new baby. That's
a
big financial responsibility for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It doesn't work this way, that the government spending priorities are very different.
Now, you're bringing up a really good point, and that is you're talking about your budget. I'm talking about my budget. The scope of my spending is very limited. I'm I'm looking at what I need to do, what I need to save for my family. You're doing the same for you. And it doesn't work that way. The way that the government works is there are so many people the government has to think of. There are other things, too, that most families don't have to think about. What comes to mind for me, for example, is defense spending. I mean, we as a country spend about a fifth of our budget on the Defense Department, on military spending. I can't really think of something analogous in my own budget there. And then think about Social Security and Medicare.
I'm not planning on attacking my neighbors.
They'll be happy to hear that. And then there's Social Security and Medicare. There are these sort of social welfare programs. Again, a big chunk of the budget goes to that. And, you know, if you try to tease that out, I mean, is grandma giving you some money to put into a pot for most of her life? And then later in her life, you're going to be taking that plus some of your own money to pay for all of her expenses. It just doesn't work out when you play it all out.
Well, then there's the question of money itself, right? I mean, the government can tax people. That's not how you and I operate.
No, I think that if in the future I were to do that to my daughter, once I'm paying her allowance, I know that she wouldn't appreciate that. And I think, you know, the government is able to print money. And I don't know any families who are, at least I won't admit to knowing any families who are counterfeiting money in their basements. But, you know, that's something that really sets them apart from your average family. And it's another example of how this analogy doesn't work.
Well, as does the question of borrowing. We are talking about very low rates. Neither you nor I can borrow at 2.6% if we're talking about, say, a 10-year loan here.
No, I mean, if I have a pretty good credit rating myself, if I may toot my own horn. But the interest that I have on my credit card is nowhere near 2.anything%.
But then, David, there's the reason we're having this discussion in the first place, which is the level of overall debt that the U.S. is at. Now, we're not talking about deficits. That's the annual difference between spending and revenue. Right. But debt, where are we at?
Yeah, so the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, came out with the debt-to-GDP ratio, which sounds very wonky, but that number was 73%. That seems at face like such a huge number, but you have to remember that the U.S. government is able to take on debt at such a low interest rate compared to you or me, and if they can take money out at 2-point-something percent, that's not going to be as bad in the long term as if they were taking it out at, you know, 14% or 19%, which are, you know, common credit card interest rates.
David Gura is a Washington correspondent for Marketplace. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
As David Gura just pointed out, when most Americans buy houses, they borrow money. They have mortgages, and so they pay attention to rates and prices. This week, Case-Shiller, a closely watched index of the housing market, came out with its survey of 20 cities. Prices are up in all of them. Plus, we're seeing an overall rise in mortgage rates, and that's got some of you wondering, is now the time to buy? We invited Elise Glink to give us some perspective. She's a personal finance expert and author. Good to talk to you, Elise.
Nice to be here, Lizzie.
So I want to start with some housing news. The Case-Shiller Index, which everybody watches, came out this week, and it said in July, single-family home prices rose. So they were up everywhere in the cities that get measured, but they rose slower in July than they did in June. How do you read what the survey said?
Just look at the year-to-year comparison, and you want to, like, hold your hat on your head because it might blow your head off. Home prices are up like 12% in a year. That, if they were stocks, would still be a remarkable rise. It would be a mind-blowing rise. But for houses, which never usually move faster than just over the rate of inflation, which right now is about 2% in this country, if you're lucky, to have a 12% rise in a year is just absolutely astonishing. And so the fact that it's now slowing a bit, I think, is actually a very good thing for the housing market, because if you kept going up at 12% a year, pretty soon nobody would be able to afford to buy a house, and a lot of people would be unemployed again.
We've got this chicken and egg quality going on with home prices and mortgage rates as well. Mortgage rates have been inching up, yet the Federal Reserve said, well, we're not going to stop our bond buying program just yet. We don't see enough oomph in the economy. What do you think that's going to do to the housing recovery?
Well, we're already seeing mortgage interest rates start to drop again. They're back at around 4.5%, 4.33%. Depends how much you want to pay for it. In fact, if 2 years ago I would come on the show, I would say to you, 4.5% for a 30-year fixed rate loan, that's unbelievable. And the problem is so many buyers have gotten used to hearing a 3 in front of that number that 4 just seems insanely high. And pretty soon they'll all figure out that 4.5% for a 30-year fixed rate loan is remarkable.
All right. So these numbers can seem kind of opaque and squishy to people, but they have a tremendous impact on people's lives. We're going to bring in our caller, Calvin, in San Francisco, because these numbers impact what's going to happen in his life. He's trying to figure out how to balance saving for retirement and looking at buying a house. Hi, Calvin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're in kind of an interesting situation in that you're a medical resident, but you know in a couple of years that you and your partner are going to be making a better income than you're making right now as residents. Tell me about your financial picture.
Sure. So my fiance and I are both residents, as you mentioned. So we have a limited income here in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is enough to live on, but not much else to save. And so we've been putting as much as we can towards retirement, but we'd like to buy a house in the next couple of years. And seeing how we're going to be making a substantially more amount of money in a few years, I was wondering what your thoughts would be about sort of stopping saving for retirement now and just putting everything we can towards a down payment so that we can buy a house in a couple of years.
Are you and or your fiance carrying any big debt? I know that there are some medical residents who, by the time they get to where you are, they've got $1 million between college loans and medical school loans and the cost of actually living. Are you carrying any debt with you into the future?
Sure. So both her and I are actually pretty fortunate in that we are carrying very minimal to no debt between the two of us. And by the end of the year, won't have any debt to speak of.
Which is fantastic.
That's great.
It's amazing. How old are you both?
So I am 28 and she is 29.
My initial reaction would be to say, you know what, Skip, you've already started putting some stuff away for retirement. Good for you. And that's really what you should do when you're young. But since you live in a very high cost area, which isn't getting any cheaper, I mean, there was barely a dip in the home prices out in the San Francisco area.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to like literally sneeze and you would have missed it. I think what you ought to do is to start directing some more money into this down payment, because one of the things that's going to be harder to get going forward is a higher interest rate loan at better prices. So I think for the next couple of years, if that's how long your time horizon is, pump everything you can into saving for that house. I don't think it's going to really change your picture much for your retirement.
Yeah. Have you done any looking?
I've started looking and I got scared away by the prices.
Yeah, I'd like to say they're going to get better over the next couple of years, but they won't. Within the next 2 years, hopefully, the economy is going to be strong enough and the Fed is going to raise their discount rate. And that means that mortgage interest rates will follow suit. And so you're going to run into this kind of problem that a lot of people run into, where it's, if you wait too long because you're saving up for a down payment, the interest rates will rise. You'll be able to afford less of a house. And you may actually have a higher payment. And with all these new minted, you know, internet millionaires that seem to be, you know, peeling off the lot here, I think Twitter's going to mint another 100 of them or so. You're going to have some stiff competition for housing. So it's going to be important to be able to move fast when you're ready.
All right. Well, we'll keep that in mind and have a long talk tonight.
No kidding. Thank you very much for calling in. And I hope we've been helpful.
You've been very helpful. Thank you. Have a nice day.
All right. Elise Glink is a personal finance expert and an author. Thanks a lot, Elise.
It's a pleasure.
Just ahead, oh joy, hospital billing.
What facility is she paying for here? The toilets? The closet? Her insurer should be the one stepping up and dealing with the healthcare provider here to get rid of this fee.
Fine print run amok. What you can do to fight fees. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. About housing this week, we got letters on a whole range of financial issues, especially ones about you as a consumer and how you interact with companies big and small. We've all had experiences of dealing with fees and hidden charges. So we brought in Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus to answer your questions. Welcome back, David.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We've got our first caller with us, and it's Debbie in York, Pennsylvania. Hi, Debbie. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hello.
Debbie, what's your situation? I gather you had a medical situation that got a bit out of control.
Well, it was the billing, actually, that really surprised me. I went to a walk-in clinic with a rash on my ankle, so just something very simple. The doctor looked at it, told me it was poison ivy, and the walk-in clinic is a member of my insurance's network. Paid the $15 copay that day and went on my way. Shortly thereafter, I get an explanation of benefits from my insurance company, which shows two separate billing items, one for the visit, and then there was an additional $50 charge. And I wasn't sure what the $50 charge was, so I called the walk-in clinic up. They said the billing is done through a third-party facility, so they gave me the number, called that number. And they told me the $50 charge was a facilities charge for the walk-in clinic to be there, I guess.
And what did you say to them?
I said, well, doesn't any place you go has a facility? Was I supposed to meet the doctor out on the street corner or something? I mean, and of course, my insurance says they're not paying a $50 facilities charge.
Well, what happened?
When I called the third-party billing place and they told me it was a facilities charge, the first person I talked to said, oh, no, it should probably be taken off. because I had gone to that clinic once before about a year ago and wasn't charged that. Shortly after I talked to the first person, a second person called me back and said, oh, no, no, that $50 is going to be charged. You'll be billed for it. At which time I told him, well, I probably will not be paying this because I just don't feel it's an ethical charge. And yes, it's only $50, but I just didn't feel I should have to pay it. And he said, well, it'll go through the regular three-cycle billing thing, and then it'll be turned over to a collections agency if that's what you feel. And I said, well, fine, so be it. Then he went ahead, or somebody went ahead, and billed my credit card that I had used the day when I went for the first visit for the $15. Now, I've since called my credit card company to try to dispute it, and they told me that they can't really take it off because it's a valid charge because the facility had the charge card number on file from the previous transactions I did with them.
Well, I bet David has thoughts about this. David, have you ever heard of a facilities fee or something like this happening?
Oh, absolutely. And this is messed up on many levels, clearly. A facilities charge typically applies when you go to a hospital, a large facility. A walk-in clinic, I haven't really heard of many examples of that. Now, there are a number of things to address here. First of all, Deborah's exactly correct. What facility is she paying for here? The toilets? The closet? Right. I mean, what facility is it? I mean, that's one thing. Another thing is her insurer should be the one stepping up and dealing with the healthcare provider here to get rid of this fee. It's not like the insurer should just be wiping their hands of it and saying, walking away and saying, it's your problem, not ours. That's not the way the insurer is supposed to work. And then finally, the idea that they're going to ding your credit card simply because they can without your authorization certainly seems to be walking around a few moral and ethical lines here. But here's what we're looking at. This is the brave new world of cost shifting. And cost shifting is what happens in the healthcare world when basically a healthcare facility, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a clinic, whether it's just a doctor's office, wants to ding an insured person for the costs of treating uninsured people. So what they're doing is they're slapping you with these bogus charges or raising charges for things that are perfectly normal, like, say, anesthesia or bandages or saline or tests. They charge wildly ridiculous prices for those. So, again, they can take some cream off the top and apply that to their costs in treating the uninsured. Is any of that fair? No. Is it business as usual? Yes.
What resources are available, David, for people who are in a situation like Debbie's, either now or will there be any more or less once the Affordable Care Act starts to kick in?
Well, the Affordable Care Act isn't really going to address things like this. It doesn't get at costs or pricing to a great degree. There's some elements to it. What the Affordable Care Act does, at least right out of the gate, is try to go after the 50 million uninsured and bring as many as possible into the fold. So what Debbie and others in her position should do is, first of all, you appeal to the hospital or to the clinic in this case. They will have a dispute process. Jump through those hoops. It's worth it. Also, work with your insurer. Your insurer has an obligation to try and handle billing questions. That's what the insurer is there for. That's how they've cut them in for a piece of the action. So the idea that they're going to take their piece and walk away doesn't seem fair at all. You are paying premiums to them. Therefore, they do have some responsibilities here. Now, if none of that gets you anywhere, you always have other choices. For instance, there are folks out there called patient advocates. And what you can do is do a Google search for patient advocate in your area, and so put in the right parameters, and you'll get people who exist solely to step in and be an intermediary. These are people who have a lot of experience in the healthcare equation and can help do blocking and tackling in this sort of thing. Now, for a $50 charge, I don't know if it's going to be worth it per se.
So a patient advocate, would that normally be a charge?
Yeah,
they're
not in it out of the goodness of their hearts.
Okay.
So when you have a situation where you're looking at thousands of dollars that's where a patient advocate can be very helpful and save you some money. $50, you know, you can shop around a little bit. You can see if somebody might do it. You can even see if someone will just simply give you some advice pro bono over the phone. And then, you know, as a last recourse, if you just want to get your voice heard after you pony up the $50, you can contact the Department of Insurance in your state. You can also contact the Attorney General in your state, and you can contact the FTC at the federal level and just simply say, this is an unfair business practice and I want to protest.
Oh, okay. I've made note of all these things. It gives me a few more things. I will go back maybe and appeal to the clinic again and go back to the insurer. When I did talk to the insurance, they basically said they have no control over what a facility bills.
Yeah, but they've got more muscle than you do. And quite simply, if they start exercising it, oftentimes a practitioner will back down because they don't want the hassle either. But I would advise making the stink. I'm a big believer in squeaky wheels and grease.
Debbie, thank you so much for calling us. I hope this has at least given you a couple of options.
Yes, it has. Thanks for taking my call.
David, stick around. We've got more questions for you just after the break. This is Marketplace Money from APM. David Lazarus is my guest this hour. He's the consumer columnist at the LA Times. We've got a letter from a listener in Alamo, Idaho. Her name is Kristen, and she wrote to us about her father, who is 70. Kristen's dad is a retired employee of the FDIC, and he worked for years as a bank examiner. Right now, she's a little bit worried about him because, according to her, he pays for account monitoring services to ward off unauthorized use of his financial accounts and to ward off identity theft. But Kristen wonders if what he's paying for is actually worth it. So what do account monitoring services do besides alert you of suspicious activity? And are there some that will do more than others to protect your money? All right, David, give us the skinny on account monitoring services.
All right, the skinny here is, first of all, they do exactly what you're talking about here. You've got your credit files with the major credit reporting companies, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And if something untoward is happening, if someone has your social security number, if someone has other elements of your identity and is trying to commit some fraud, credit monitoring is going to be your first line of defense, just to know that something hinky is going on out there and that someone's going to have to do something about it, more than likely you, the consumer, because if you don't do it, it's not like there's a bunch of ninjas that are going to come storming out and protect you in this case. Now, I thought the interesting thing in the letter was your use of the plural, that this gentleman has multiple services. And I think that's where the wrong turn was taken, because there really is no need. There are services out there called 3-in-1 services that monitor all 3 credit files and then bring it all together and keep you alerted to all of them. And that's exactly the way you want to do it. And there's a charge to it. Different companies will offer different rates on these things. But generally speaking, not a bad idea if you're concerned about your credit. Now, there's other things you can do. You can put fraud watches on your file. You can even freeze your credit files if you want to make sure that nobody can get at them. But I wouldn't say that's for everybody. I mean, it's got a fixed cost, a monthly cost, and in most cases, you don't need that level of protection. And here's what you should do instead. There is a service out there called annualcreditreport.com. And this allows you to get one free credit report from each one of the major agencies once per year. Thus, if you space it out every 4 months, you're going to have year-round credit monitoring. Now, it's not foolproof, because different creditors will use different credit reporting companies. You spread it out like this, and it's poor man's credit monitoring right here. And here's another good tip, too. Not in every state, but in some states, AAA will offer free credit monitoring on your Experian file. And so you might want to contact AAA and see if you're eligible for that, because that's a terrific service as well.
David, wow, thank you.
Here to please. That's what I'm here for.
All right, we're going to get another caller on the line. We've got Chris in Michigan. You're in Grand Rapids, is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
My dad's from Michigan. I love your state very much.
Oh, me too.
Tell me about your situation. I gather you've had kind of a bumpy experience trying to buy a house.
Oh, definitely. I mean, who hasn't nowadays? But my partner and I went to get a mortgage, and we got pre-qualified. We found a house, and then we went to the bank and did the more in-depth part where we gave them bank statements and W-2s and everything. And a couple days later, we got our good faith estimate, and we weren't really satisfied with it, and we wanted to kind of shop around. So we went to another bank, and we thought about going with the second bank. And so for some reason, we thought, oh, I think we're going to get charged if we decide not to continue forward with the original bank. So we called them, and they said, yes, you would be charged the $400 for the application fee, and we've already scheduled the appraisal. And so we decided, okay, well, this other bank said they could save us $400, so it's a wash. We'll just continue with our original bank. We feel like we kind of gotten taken advantage of, because I thought I read somewhere that a bank can only charge you for the credit check before moving forward with them.
And what happened? Did you end up getting the house?
Yeah, we got the house. We got the mortgage at 4.5%. Everything went fine, but just the fact that we felt like maybe we were lied to continue on with the bank kind of left a bad taste in our mouth.
Understandably. David, what do you think?
Well, I think the bad taste is understandable, but you were jumping through all the hoops that most people have to jump through. And I think the first thing that's questionable here is the size of the application fee. In your case, $400. I've heard of some application fees that are as much as $500. This is crazy because there's going to be a whole mountain of other fees coming down at you. So the idea that just to get the ball rolling, you've got to cough up hundreds of dollars seems, grossly unfair and grossly, out of line with the service you're getting. However, banks do this because they know that you're going to shop around, and they want to make sure that they can get a little piece of the action before you move on to somebody who may offer a better deal. Now, if you got a good faith estimate from these guys, and did you?
Yes, we did.
Okay. You can't get a good faith estimate from a lender without agreeing to the application fee. That's a part of the process. They don't do that out of the goodness of their hearts because they want to win your business. No, they're doing that because you have come through the door and expressed an interest in it, and now there is a fee that's being attached to that. Therefore, the good faith estimate is what that $400 is all about. Now, should people do this knowing that? My answer to that is, yeah, you should. Shopping around can make a big difference when it comes to a mortgage. And even though, let's say you go to three lenders, let's say they all charge a $400 fee, and you're looking at $1,200 in fees right here. Well, in reality, by shopping around and finding the best possible offer, you can save thousands of dollars over the life of the loan. So even though it seems like a hassle, even though it seems enormously overpriced, it can make a lot of sense.
Chris, were you happy with the price that you ended up with and the loan that you ended up with on the house?
Yes, we were. And we went further on with the bank, and it turns out that application fee was actually reimbursed at the very end. So we didn't end up paying that $400 because it was reimbursed to us in our HUD statement and with closing. So and I read on their online page, their website, that is typical for that bank.
Now, that was from the lender that you actually agreed to the mortgage with, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
So in that case, they're able to use that as an inducement. And that is, if you agree to do business with us, we're going to waive that fee that essentially all the lenders are charging just for you having walked in the door. And that's great. That's the stand-up thing for them to do. But at the same time, again, they're not great humanitarians, because when you look at all those other fees and that phone book size stack of paper that you're going to have to wrestle with to get that home loan, come on, they're still coming out way ahead.
Exactly.
Chris, I'm curious. You and your partner, where are you in life? Is this a first home for you?
Correct. This is the first home. I'm 30 and she's 28.
I'm just wondering if you feel like you had a good experience with this bank. I'm wondering whether it's one that you'd go back to if you thought about moving up, buying another home down the road.
Probably not. You learn things along the way. But, we'd probably go with a different one. I know our realtor recommended this loan officer, and being first-time homebuyers, we were thinking, okay, well, this guy's on our side. You know, he must know who is good to go to. So we took our realtor's advice.
Keep this in mind, Chris, that when you have your mortgage with a particular bank, if you bring them other business, you're going to get some big savings in terms of, say, monthly checking account fees, safe deposit box fees, and other such fees. So if you do decide that it's a bank you like and that you want to bring some of your other business under the roof, make sure you ask them about the various perks and savings you will get as somebody who has a large volume of business with them, and it's your mortgage that's typically going to be the big tipping point there, because that's what they want to keep in place and that's what they want to build off of. So you do have a little bit of leverage now if you choose to try to negotiate better terms for ancillary accounts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you so much. I've really appreciated it, and I listen to your show every week.
Well, I appreciate that. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, you too.
That was Chris, and David Lazarus has been my guest this hour on Marketplace Money. David Lazarus is a consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. David, thank you so much for being with me.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, Roth IRAs versus 529 accounts. What's better for you?
If you're kind of struggling to find enough money to save for both college and retirement, or if you're not sure if your kids are going to go to college or not, a Roth is a good way to save.
We tackle your follow-up questions on saving for college. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. Jobs numbers come out next week. You know, where we get the unemployment rate, find out how many jobs were created. And if you dig deep into those numbers, you'll find the labor force participation rate. That's the percentage of Americans either working or actively looking for jobs. And that rate is the lowest it's been in more than three decades. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins me, and he found something very interesting in that statistic. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Lizzie. It's good to be here.
All right. You found something pretty interesting, or rather, some people who aren't in the workforce. What'd you find?
There are 600,000 missing boomer women. Women 55 or older, the Bureau of Labor Statistics expected them to be in the workforce, either working, you know, most of them, or at least looking for work. They simply have disappeared. Boomer men, not nearly as many as the women. 130,000 of those women are actually over 75, but still expected to still be working and earning money and earning benefits towards Social Security and retirement.
What did you find in your reporting? Are there any hints about where they went?
I would say they roughly broke into three groups. There are women who are simply terribly, terribly discouraged. They've been trying maybe for years to get back into the workforce after a layoff, and they're just getting nothing. Another group is taking care of people, you know, either elderly parents or their own adult children's children, their grandchildren, so their adult children can work a little bit. You know, finally, some of them are probably just decided it's not worth it to keep struggling and looking. I'm going to retire early, you know, at least have enough money to try to make a go of that.
Well, this is a personal finance show. When we talk about those different financial responsibilities that people are facing and what they do with their money, when you spoke to these women, what were they struggling with? What were the personal finance problems that were making them stay up at night?
They've almost universally lost the value of their homes, lost you know, the value of 401ks, pensions are, you know, iffy these days. They know that if they don't keep working or get back into the labor force, you know, in the next few years until they turn 66 or, you know, even make it to 70, their Social Security benefits will be much lower than they had hoped and than they expected. I talked to Olivia Mitchell about this. She's at the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School. And she says she's particularly concerned for people in the middle income bracket who mostly will likely be relying on Social Security and Medicare.
It's the middle group that I'm concerned about, which increasingly is going to become more and more female, since women do live much longer than men. And so it's that particular vulnerable set that I think should really get the message and start getting it soon. Work longer, save more, and unfortunately, probably expect less.
Expect less is kind of a depressing message to hear, but I would imagine that a lot of the women you talked to were trying to figure out what options exist for them. What were they hearing?
They're hearing, get a job, get back into the job market. Of course, the problem is it is really hard for older workers once they do get laid off or quit to find new jobs. It's just very hard. It's one of the hardest groups of workers to reemploy. But, you know, it is really hard for these women, especially since they're quite likely to be taking care of someone. I met Nancy Biskey. She's 58. And after a layoff, she ended up having to take care of her parents, get them into assisted living. And now she's trying to get back in.
So it took quite a while to kind of get into a situation of where I go, okay, now I need to start looking for a job again. I don't want to leave the workforce right now. I've been out of it for a long enough time. I'm ready to get back in and get kind of energized.
I was thinking about this generation, and it is very much a generation defined by feminism and women in the workplace. Some of them took time off to have kids, may have left the workforce, come back in. Did they feel at all when you spoke to them kind of let down by society?
I would use the word pissed off, maybe. They've made it as workers. They've made it as wage earners. And suddenly they can't take care of themselves. And they're really, really worried. One of them said to me, you know, my own parents lived into their 90s. I've got to work for a while to make sure I can make it that long.
Mitchell Hartman, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lizzie.
Weeks ago, during our show on college and student debt, we had a segment on 529s. Those are the college savings plans named after the tax code. We got a lot of follow-up questions after it aired, and we invited Kimberly Langford back to answer them. She contributes to Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we've got a lot of follow-up questions to the conversation you and I had before, and I want to start with one that we got a couple of times. What is a better way to save for college, a 529 or a Roth IRA?
Well, and that's a great question because both of them can be good ways to save for college. The Roth definitely has some benefits because it can do double duty. So if you're kind of struggling to find enough money to save for both college and retirement, or if you're not sure if your kids are going to go to college or not, a Roth is a good way to save. I mean, the money goes in after tax, but can be used tax-free for retirement. But the key thing for college is that you can access your contributions tax and penalty-free at any age. So you have to be over 59 and a half to be able to get those earnings tax-free. But when your kids are in college, that could be a good time to withdraw some of that money tax and penalty-free that you've put in, just those contributions. Now, the problem is that you can only invest up to $5,500 a year currently in a Roth IRA or $6,500 if you're age 50 or older. So, you know, you don't have a lot of money getting that benefit. But if you do have enough money to be able to save in both a Roth and a 529, you're going to get extra benefits from that. I mean, the 529 lets you save tax-deferred, can use the money tax-free for college costs, and in about two-thirds of the states, you get a state income tax deduction for your contributions, which you don't get with a Roth IRA.
So if you know your kid is going to go to college, which one should you open first?
take a look at what the 529 tax break is. Definitely take a look at what that income tax deduction is for your state. And if it's a really valuable state tax deduction, take a look at that first. However, if you are juggling, you know, trying to save for college and retirement, that's where the Roth IRA really comes in. I'd say, though, try to invest up to the amount of the tax deduction for the 529 and then consider the Roth IRA.
All right, I've got a Facebook question for you. If you have more than one kid, do you open more than one account for each, or do you just have a big one and put all the money in there?
Well, this is a very interesting question, and lots of people have different philosophies towards this. I mean, I personally say that it's generally better to have separate accounts for each child, and especially if they're pretty far apart in age, if they're more than several years apart in age, because as the child gets closer to college age, you're going to gradually want to shift that money to be more conservative. For the kids that are younger, you could keep that money more aggressively invested, you know, more stock funds versus fixed income funds at that point, and gradually shift it. And if you have a whole bunch of kids all lumped into one account, it's really hard to know how to adjust that money. But on the flip side, you also want to make sure that you're not paying separate fees for each account that you open up. So really take a look at how those fees are assessed for the particular account that you're looking at and make sure that you're not being penalized for having a bunch of different accounts. But the other good thing is you can always make changes. So if you do end up contributing more money to one account than another, or if you just end up having it all in one account to begin with, and then you realize you want to shift some to a younger child, you can either change the beneficiary on that account, or you can open a new account and transfer some of the money from the first account to the second one. Also, check on any fees that your 529 may assess for that too, but it really is not that hard to shift the money from one child to another, or one family member to another. There's a specific list of family members you can shift money to, but anyone, your children, grandchildren, their siblings, things like that, really easy to shift the money.
We're going to get to that question of more than one kid and how you prepare to send multiple children to college. We have Colleen from Minneapolis. Hi, Colleen. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hello.
Give me a sense of your situation. I know you've got one child who's getting ready to go to college and you've been doing some saving for him. Tell me about that.
Yes, I opened a 529 account when he was about 8, and right now he is a junior in high school. And I've been putting in some money over the years, and it's varied. And now that college is next year, I've doubled that contribution. So I was wondering if that's even worth doubling the contribution now and continuing to put it in the 529 account, and should I be putting that money that might be used the following year in the 529 account if he gets through college, or should that be put elsewhere as well?
Well, that's a great point about the year-by-year paying. And the key thing is that even though he's going to be starting college next year, you still have about 5 years until you have that final bill due. Also, if you continue to contribute to the 529, you can still get that state income tax break if you have one in your state for your contribution. So you're also going to be stretching the money that way as well. And do you have other children, too?
I have a 3-year-old.
Oh, well, the good news is you can start to save some of the money for the younger child, and that money will then have a very long time to grow and, you know, build up that tax-free growth that can be used for college way in the future. Or you can, you know, keep some of the money for your older child in the account and then decide what to do from there. Decide if you want to keep some of that money in the account and eventually switch it over to your younger child, or if you want to use that all for his college bills.
Now, if there is still money left in the 529 after he graduates, should I move it to one of those lower age-based funds for my daughter?
You can change the beneficiary to your daughter. And yes, that's when it's going to be really important to change that, because your entire investment strategy is going to be different because your daughter has so much more time before college. So that's a mistake people make, too, is they might change the beneficiary but forget to change the investments.
Thank you so much for your question. I'm curious what you're going to do next.
So I'll pretty much pay as I go and then dip into the 529 as I need it and continue to contribute the money that I was going to pay into the 529 and save whatever's left over for my daughter.
And you've definitely got a lot of time for her. Thank you so much for your call, Colleen.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Langford, thank you so much for your advice. Kimberly is a columnist for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for the great questions.
And you can get all the answers to your 529 questions online at marketplacemoney.org. October 1st is when the health insurance exchanges will open. Those exchanges are a centerpiece of the Affordable Care Act. You can shop for a health care plan if you don't have insurance. And that includes self-employed workers like Micheline Maynard. She's a journalist who's been on the show before, and she's in the process of figuring out her insurance coverage. We wanted to get a sense of what that calculation has been like. Welcome back to the program, Mickey.
Thank you very much, Lizzie.
Explain your healthcare and work situation to me right now.
I teach this year at Central Michigan University and at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And usually during the time I'm teaching, I'm paid a salary and, in the case of CMU, benefits. And then I'm also the editor of this new journalism venture, Curbing Cars, and I'm a freelance journalist, although I write primarily for Forbes and for Time and a couple of other publications.
Tell me about your insurance picture.
While I was teaching at CMU, because of the union contract, we had medical benefits. If you have an appointment for part of the school year, you actually get your health care through August. So I've actually gotten Central Michigan University health care plan from January through August. That just expired. And I got the letter from CMU saying, you're welcome to join our COBRA plan. That's an extension of your medical benefits from your employer, but you pay for it.
How much are you paying for COBRA?
Well, the COBRA that I elected, which is medical plus prescription coverage, will be about $491 a month. I could Whoa. Get it without prescription coverage, but I actually talked to CVS Pharmacy about I take three prescriptions, and I said, what would they cost if I bought them? And they said, over $100 if I just use the prescription coverage that I've been getting. They're about $7 a month.
You're in kind of an interesting place because you more or less work for yourself. You do a bunch of different assignments. I gather that you've looked at the Affordable Care Act calculators to figure out if getting insurance that way would work for you. What have you found?
Before I even decided to take the COBRA, I went on the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan site and I did their calculators. And they actually do offer an individual health care plan. The one that was closest to what I was paying had a $6,000 deductible. So that I dismissed. To get close to what I was getting in the COBRA would have been under $1,000, but not much under $1,000. So then I went on the Affordable Healthcare site to start doing some research. And you click on some boxes, fill in some information, and basically you're told, here are some of your options.
What does an insurance policy have to cost to be worth it to you?
I was thinking earlier today about this, and, you know, I do a monthly budget, and I have to budget for rent, utilities, you know, your basic expenses per month. And I realized that baking in COBRA means I basically have to bake in another $500 a month in expenses, which I was prepared for. If I could get health care for $300, $400 a month, I would be very, very happy. However, I'm not sure that's going to be possible. I just don't know.
How healthy would you say you are? Do you need a lot of health care or not so much when you're shopping?
I consider myself to be pretty healthy. I'm on a weight loss plan right now. I exercise 3 or 4 times a week. My one issue is a heredity thing with actually high triglycerides, so I take a little medication for that. And I had a surgical condition 20 years or so ago, and I have to take some medication for that. But I don't smoke. I drink very little. I try to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So I would say healthy. I feel like I'm probably the ideal person to be insured at this point.
In your research, when you've gone online, what did you find? What was that like?
Confusing, because you have to know essentially, you know, what's a deductible? What's a copay? What, obviously, if I'm single, but if I were a family, I would need to know information about the health of my spouse, the health of my children. You really better have all that at your fingertips, and you really need to have a feeling for what you can afford. And that's all going to have to be filled in after the 1st of October.
Mickey Maynard is the editor of Curbing Cars and the contributor to Forbes.com. Thank you, Mickey.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie.
We're going to check back in with Mickey to hear how the comparison shopping is going post-October 1st. And we want to hear your experiences, too, if you're buying insurance on the exchanges or choosing not to, or have questions about health insurance coverage. You can write us. Click on the contact link at marketplacemoney.org. All right, that's it for Marketplace Money this week. We want your feedback. Write us at marketplacemoney.org or on our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, it's good for you. We promise.
A lot of people have checked it at some point, but it's not part of the regular regime. I do believe it's like flossing. You know you should do it, but you kind of can't quite get around to it.
Credit report hygiene. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster-Thomas and Daryl Perinato, with help this week from Mary Dew. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is APM.